Mike, alcoholic.
Right.
And like Katie, I missed the thank yous, and particularly to Brandon rescuing me from the airport. I got up at 4:30, and I'm not a morning person. I take some cancer meds, and so they kind of keep me on my back most of the morning in normal circumstances. So I was up at 4:30, and it wasn't pretty. By the time I got to Birmingham, I was just kind of walking in circles, and Brandon picked me up and got me some barbecue and straightened me out here and everything. And Tarek, this is like our fourth dance together, and he's always taken great care of me, and I want to acknowledge that. So talk a little bit in a more specific way about the first step. And I think, we're probably all familiar with the, when you honestly want to, you can't quit entirely, all that stuff. Yeah. But it's vital in my experience. One of the guys I sponsor is a guy named Mickey out in Colorado, and Mickey's 48 years sober. And we do the steps together every year. Between sponsor, sponsee, he does other work, but the way I breathe, Mickey, what 48 years sober and married to the same woman for 51 years, how does powerlessness show up in your life today? How does unmanageability show up in your life today? See, it's not the Wayback Machine. It's not all the stuff I did when I was a teenager and a young adult and all that other stuff. I mean, it's not inconsequential. I had to deal with it in the beginning. But it's the ego's, for me, the ego's subtle way of putting my problems in the rearview mirror. Well, yeah, there was that time in college when I done it, no. I'm powerless. I'm trying to get my wife to do things the way I want to, and it's not going well around the house. I'm trying to get my business partner to run the office the way I think it should be run. I'm trying to get my home group. Unfortunately, we've been such a good home group that we get all these people that come to it, and they think they ought to have some say in what goes on in the home group. What the hell, And so it's about keeping it current. And I recommend that to you. The other thing is that my experience is that these steps are very much interlocking and not necessarily sequential. I'm going to share just a quick bit of sex conduct inventory, that this is where I really got a first step that I've been able to keep from. This little tiny piece of inventory here. And this was about the my college sweetheart. She had three brothers, and there were three girls. I loved her mom and dad. I palled around with her dad. He and I went hunting and fishing. All, buddies with the brothers, all this. I didn't just love her. I loved this family. And I wanted to be part of this family for the rest of my life. That was a sincerely held desire. And here's what I came up with when I wrote a piece of conduct inventory about that relationship. Ellen, where was I selfish? Well, I wanted to enjoy sex with her regardless of the consequences. I was dishonest. I told her, don't worry, I'll always be there for you no matter what. I dishonestly refused to consider my ability and willingness to keep that promise. I was inconsiderate. I gave scant consideration to the consequences of my behavior to her, her family, her faith, her reputation, and her career. You know, I love you, so what I want must be right, right? Or you'll come around to my way of thinking. Yeah. I aroused jealousy. I told her if she didn't have sex with me, I'd get it elsewhere. Isn't that a sweet deal? See, you do things like that in pursuit of somebody you actually love, and you question whether the fact that you were insane out there. This is insanity. It's a description of insanity as much as anything else. I told her if she didn't have sex with me, I paid undue attention to other women in her presence. Oh, you know. I remarked, let her know how attractive I found them. I aroused suspicion. I often spent time alone with other women, and on one really bad Friday night, she found me at Holly's apartment. I aroused bitterness. I finally wore her down. I'm persistent. When she became pregnant, I told her I doubted it was my child. I told her mother that I was too young to get married and didn't want to marry her anyway. And she was a woman of integrity, and she quit. She just graduated college, was well on the way to her first career job, and she quit that job, went to Sacramento, where one of her older brothers that I pal with, Terry, was working for IBM out there, and lived with him, and had the baby and put it up for adoption. And there was no email, texting, or anything else then, so there were phone calls and no caller ID, and you know, I'd get the drunken self-pity call and late at night and all that. I abandoned her and our child, and because I was the one back in the hometown, I was the one telling everybody the story about what happened. Well, she just ran off. I don't know, must have been somebody else's child. Who knows? She was embarrassed. She was blah, blah, blah. Who did I harm? Well, the baby, Ellen, her family, my family, our friends. And then to get to the gold piece of gold here, what should I have done instead? Well, when I shared this with Don, Don said anything would be an improvement over what you did. But what it did is it gave me the first little piece of an ideal. God would change you and make you into a different kind of man, what would you want that to be? And he told me something very important there. He said, God will not change you against your will. God won't, you know, God isn't going to do that. That's one of the reasons we write inventory. Because when we surrender in 6 and 7, what we're doing is we've got to have informed consent. If I was going to have a surgical operation, they're going to tell me exactly what they're going to do and what the conditions will be and this and that. And they say, you know, Mr. Lorenz, do you give your consent? I don't get to perform my own surgery, but there is consent there. And so for me, I have a God of informed consent, that God is not going to change me against my will into something that I do not want to be or find objectionable. So here's this first ideal here. I should have treated sex as the sacred gift it is. I shouldn't have engaged in behavior that I wasn't willing to be responsible for. I should have honestly faced the consequences of my actions. I should have been honest with myself and others. My harms were all rooted in dishonesty, particularly about how afraid I was. And then I got a little gift here. I didn't know it until it was explained to me. It was a spiritual awakening. Self-reliance will always produce fear and pain. Who knew? But that was a start. And why did I say first step here? Because I knew how much I loved her, how much I cared for that family, what a dream of over years had been to. And in spite of all of that, it turns out if I love you, I'm going to hurt you. I'm going to hurt the people I love the most, and there's not a damn thing I can do about it. And that's real powerlessness in my eyes. That was more like than bottles doing push-ups in the parking lot or some other thing. The fact that I knew in a way I could not deny that if I loved you, I was going to hurt you in a real deep, nasty way. And I'd done it to my siblings, to my parents, to various partners over the years. And so the inventory, finally, I could have had the light go on at some other point, but it went on there. So here we go. Two important parts. I'm delightfully enjoying being married to a sane woman. Two things we both have. We both have, they're different, but they're a primary purpose and an ideal for my conduct here. And so my current ideal is I'll try to be the best of lovers by being the best of friends and seeking each day to contribute to rather than to take from you and our relationship. My love for you doesn't give me special privileges. It gives me special responsibilities. I will listen to you and God, and you will teach me how to do this if I'm faithful and attentive. So anytime I'm twisted up with my dear wife, and Katie knows her, she's a sweetheart, I go back here and I reflect, is what I'm about to do or say, does it line up with who I've asked God to maybe be? And then as a couple, we have great respect for our traditions, particularly in the long form, and we sat down together and came up with a primary purpose as a couple. What do we do here, and how do we go about doing it? And so our primary purpose is we will practice the active support of the growth and well-being of each other's spiritual condition. We will honor and express God's love and devotion within our relationship so that we may worship and serve God together and apart. Honor the holiness of marriage, the sanctity of service to others, and the delight of living and loving with each other without fear. And if you don't have an aspiration for where you're going, it was always kind of, we love each other, it'll work out, Hey, it's just like when you're flying in an airplane and you go into a cloud, you better have some radar and some instruments to guide you where you can't see out the window. And when the relationship gets in, all kinds of stir up things that happen in life, we got to be able to have a reference point to go, hey, this is what we said. Jess, do we still mean that? Do we still want to do that? What's that going to look like in this deal? And it's amazing. And it all came out of various pieces of working with this stuff. All that said, with the importance of the inventory, it also doesn't, I never met anybody that doesn't go through the phase where they write an inventory, get magical results, and now they've, I understand how I'm going to do it. I'm going to manage my life with inventory. Something goes wrong, I'm just going to write a little inventory about it. See, the purpose of the inventory is not for me to get information about the inner workings of Mike so I can fix Mike. If you go back to our founders, what it was about me becoming convinced that it was absolute, the idea that I could ever fix myself, no matter how much I wanted to, is futile. Because on that basis, I can make a real surrender. You know, am I really going to turn it over to you if I think there's, you know, a 10% chance I can fix this, you know, and have a parade for myself? And avoid some of the uncomfortable things of, you know, like looking at the woman I love and saying, I'm so sorry I hurt you, and I am asking God, and I will do every effort that I will never do that again. But I can't keep that promise. But I will promise that I will surrender. How many times have we promised and deeply wanted to do something and we weren't, you know, and there we go, we do it again some way or another. And it's these little chips that destroy relationships. My first wife in the program, wonderful woman, I'm blessed to still be a friend with her today. Marriage has been over for 30 years, but see, I didn't pay attention. That beautiful woman that I love would say things to me like, you know, being married to you, Mike, is the loneliest thing I've ever done. Ooh. You know, I know more about what you think, feel, and believe by listening to your half of a call from one of your sponsees than from any conversation you'll have with me. You'll be intimate with the person on the phone and tell them how you're really feeling and what's going on. I don't get that from you. That's the goal that's here for us, and a lot else if we pay attention to these things and make these things living parts of how we live our lives and demonstrate for the people we work with. Bill says a much more important demonstration of these principles in our homes, our workplace, and everything else. You know, not podium Mike. I had one other person, she says, gee, I wish I could date that guy on the bus that stands up at the podium, you know. Yeah. Got to make it real. And I don't have the power to do that. But with the with God's help and everything else. So not fixing myself with it, it convinces me of the futility of me continuing to try and fix things. And the ego doesn't like it at all. But the results are magic. So, and one last thing that I just said it here is I was taught that no matter how good my technique is or what I know about this step or that step or the book and everything else, it amounts to nothing if I don't transmit it with love. My friend Luther out in Palm Springs has got a thing up in his family room, kind of a rainbow kind of thing, and it says, life is magic, love is the wand. And that's my experience. When I've never gone wrong when I've been in doubt and confused or whatever, if I go to the love part of things. Now, she'll tell you, I'm goddamn Sergeant Lorenz. Oh. And I'm using my quiet voice now. and so forth. And so there's still a part of me, old guy that I am and all this other stuff, that you back me into a corner, I go for that tool. And that's why my being with you is vital. Thank you.
Katie Parker, alcoholic. Is that loud enough? Can you guys hear me? You know, Charlie and I had the privilege of being at a coffee shop when Sergeant Lorenz came out. And I looked at Charlie and I was like, I have never seen Sergeant Lorenz. Let me tell you. You know, see, that's one of the things that I hope we get across to you guys is that, oh my God, we are by no means out there just nailing it. You know, not at all. Thank God for the disciplines of 10 and 11. And sometimes Charlie and I will be together and he'll be doing something on the phone and he, I don't like the way his tone is with the person and I'll go. And he's like, okay. Yeah, okay, uh-huh. You know, he starts trying to tone it down a little bit. I'm like, dude, you can't talk to her like that or him or whoever it is. I just want to pick back up on the bus. I mean, you got at the end of my meeting that I was in 5 days a week, they would say a prayer when we all held hands and said, you know, the Lord's Prayer. They'd say, and let's pray for the children on Katie's bus. And, you know, don't get me wrong. God made that bus job unbelievable. I mean, I had the elementary kids over at the end of every school year for a pool party. We played games. I dyed my hair different colors. I mean, I really did the best I could considering my world was falling apart. And I mean, and it was falling apart. And Joe got sicker and sicker and sicker. And the bedevilments on page 52 are so available in sobriety. So Mark Houston, who woke us up at 17 years, and I'm telling you, it took me 4 years to come out of untreated alcoholism because that's how self-reliant I am. I left home at 15. My dad got mad at me, said, if you can't live under the rules of this house, you can't live here. I saw it as a ticket out. I went, finished high school. I mean, I'm the girl who's not going to go live on the streets. I'm going to show you what I can do. I came out of the womb like, you know, Mighty Mouse. I mean, that's just who I am, and it's still who I am. And thank God for people like Lorenz and Charlie and Marty, my sponsor, who have figured out how to reel this girl in because I was off the chain in untreated alcoholism. You know what I mean? I mean, I just, you just don't confront me because it's going to get ugly. And it doesn't matter where I am, in the grocery store, on the street, wherever. I was that kind of gal. And I'm not ashamed of it. I mean, my experience, I hope, helps you. You know, I mean, sure, there's some things, you know, I don't know that anybody I haven't made the amends to. I'm sure there's some people out there that feel like they're owed one, but I'm just not aware of it. But I've gone back and cleaned up all. I made more amends from untreated alcoholism than I ever made in active alcoholism. When you're the personality like I am, 17 years of running and gunning, you upset a lot of people. And in my business, I was a lot like the Ray Donovan. You know, I was, if you need somebody taken out, just tell me who it is, you know? And I'd take them out, and not physically kill them, but, you know, I'd take them, I'd get them to go away, and everybody at my company was like, good for you, good for you, thank you so much. It's like, who else? You know, no consideration whatsoever for that individual's life. Where they were, it just makes me want to cry, because when I went back to make the amends, there were some people who did not want to talk to me, and believe it or not, all but one person I have not made the amends. I can't find her anywhere, and I don't do social media. I've had a couple of people out there trying to find her. And I destroyed her integrity and her career. You know, it's just kind of what we do. But the bedevilments are on page 52 in the big book. So ask yourself if any of these apply. Mark used to say, turn statements into questions. And ask yourself what that means to you. We're not looking for a yes or no. We're looking for some depth. We were having trouble with our personal relationships. You know, I mean, do you talk to your family? Are you cut off from siblings? Are you in constant disarray at work? You know, I mean, ask yourself those questions, because what we tend to do is justify them. And we don't even really see, you know, we're like, no, I get along pretty well with everybody. Well, let's bring them all in. Let's see how well they're digging you, you know. We couldn't control our emotional nature, you know. I mean, I tell you what, road rage is a real deal. And I have that story coming later. You know, do you lose it with your children? Are you a screamer? Are you silent scorner? I mean, I'm silent scorner. I don't even know how to do that. I am a screamer, you know. I'm like, what are you doing? Oh, for God's sakes. You know, and I mean, that'll get people's attention, you know. And so, I mean, now today, I'm telling you, this is the new improved version of me. And I thank all the people that loved me through all of this. We were prey to misery and depression. My sponsor likes to say that's like the vulture going over waiting for the animal to die, right? We couldn't make a living. If you can make a living, are you happy making a living? You know, or do you complain about work all the time? We had a feeling of uselessness. That's a doozy. You know, there's plenty of people in this room. Trust me, there is hope, but you got to be honest with yourself. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We could not seem to be of real help to other people. Now, the tricky thing about untreated alcoholism and these bedevilments, you can have them drunk and you can have them sober. Just because the drink problem's gone doesn't mean you're not in some trouble. And that's what I like to help people wake up to that. And one of the things that I can tell you is when we were going through, Joe was sick for 6 years, and I had 3 anxiety attacks in sobriety. I'd never had one in my life. One time he handed me a plastic bag. That's a problem. Okay. You know, you just go, you know, because you're trying to breathe. I'm like, give me a bag. And I mean, that sucker just, I almost inhaled it and that game over. You know what I mean? You're like, oh my God, I can't even do an anxiety attack right, you know? But what worries me more than anything is we don't realize that I could step off a curb and tear the ligaments in my ankle so bad that I need to go to the emergency room. And the very first thing they're going to give me is pills, right? They're going to give me a shot of something. They're going to give me some pills. And what I don't realize is I'm in untreated alcoholism, and when you give me medication, it treats the allergy and triggers, it treats the malady and triggers the allergy. And it can be as simple as dental work, right? I mean, they'll give you, for serious dental work, they'll give you Vicodin like candy. And the next thing you know, you're popping a ton of pills, and you know it's wrong. But you're just buying some time, and you have no idea that that drink is waiting for you, because people say pills weren't my problem. The illness of alcoholism will take whatever it can. And you know, most people go out with pills, and then it's booze. You know what I mean? That's just what I've seen a lot of. Well, 6 years after Joe got sick, he was 23 years sober, and he ended up going back out, and he died of a heroin overdose. And I say that just rolls off my tongue. It was absolutely devastating, devastating to our family. My daughter was in college. My son was just losing his mind. And Charlie was my best friend. And I was out of my mind by that point. 6 years I tried to take care of him. Now, he was never physically ill. He was just mentally ill. I did everything. I went and found out all you can about the brain. I met with a neuropsychologist, neuropsychiatrist, didn't care for them at all. I liked the neuropsychologist. I mean, I went to brain institutes, and I'm trying to figure out, because that's what I do. You know, I go, I fix this. I've got to fix this situation. Joe and I were going to grow old together. And then all of a sudden he's gone. And I mean, the AA community was on its ear. It was devastating. And I'll tell you, singleness of purpose is a real deal. And I'll tell you, singleness of purpose, and one other thing that I don't know that I'm going to touch this weekend, is Joe was only a heroin addict. But he didn't like NA, and he got sober in the 70s. And so he ended up, you know, hiding out in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the book is very clear that until such an identification is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. Well, I had no idea that it was a big deal. I mean, I did a lot of dope. I love dope. You know, it was easier to get dope than it was booze when you're a kid. But what I didn't realize is I'm clearly alcoholic. There's no doubt about it. I never did any dope without booze. And so Joe, when he relapses, at the home group he went to, he picked a straight alcoholic only. Guy never even smoked a joint. He had no idea how to deal with a heroin addict. And I'm not blaming anybody. I just watched it play out very poorly, very, very poorly. And I even, you know, of course, I backed his sponsor in a corner because that's what I do. And Charlie would go, Katie, you got to back it down. You got to back it down. It's like, it's his fault, you know. And I have no idea what's really going on. And I got to tell you something. Charlie saved my life. He really did. He had had his plane crash, and I had lost Joe. And he's all, you know, having his awakening, and I'm losing my mind. And he's the only person that could ever get me to do anything different was Charlie Parker. And he put me in the car. I was like a wet cat, man. I didn't want to go to that Big Book weekend, whatever. And he's putting on a Chris R. tape, and I keep turning it off. I go, who is this guy telling me I'm killing newcomers? You know? And, Charlie goes, for God's sakes, could we just listen to the man? And, no, I don't want to. And we end up running in, you know, we go to Mark Houston's things. We wouldn't have driven across town for a Big Book meeting. And Charlie says, let's go 3.5 hours to a Big Book weekend. Oh, joy. Can't wait. You know, I knew everything already. And when we got there, let me tell you something. Mark Houston woke Charlie up, did not wake me up. Because, you know, I'm self-reliant, man. You want me to set down this tool that has worked so beautifully for me all my life? I'm not going to do it. I'm not convinced that self-reliance didn't work. It may not work every time, but it works a lot of times. And Charlie's just having this major experience. We're at this Big Book weekend, and Mark has us doing, you know, an evening review, and he hands out the paperwork, and Charlie's over there doing it in the room. And I go, you are such a suck-up. You are such a suck-up. Well, that wasn't what I said. I'm being kind. Okay, brown nose or suck up. And he goes, well, aren't you going to do it? And I'm like, I'm not doing that. What the? Whatever. You know, and thank God Charlie was having this awakening. Because I'm telling you something, the obsession to drink came back for me. And people say you can't beat it. Oh, yeah, you can. You can beat it right up to the day you pick up a drink. And I'm telling you what, that is a game of Russian roulette. And I told Charlie, I said, the obsession is back. And actually what I said is the monkey's on my back, because I didn't understand the lingo. And he goes, well, don't drink without me. Whatever that means. It bought me some time, man. That lame stuff works. And it's so wild when you look back at all of that. But I got to tell you something. I am walking. Was this after Mark Houston when I was at Austin City Limits? Yeah. So I'm not having the awakening Charlie's having. And I'm walking at Austin City Limits. We're having their big festival. And, you know, that's what I used to love to do when I was drinking and using and, you know, the band and the whole nine yards. And I'm in my little shorts, my little crop top and my little cowboy hat. And my son's running around probably doing a little acid somewhere, you know, and teenage boy. And REM was playing, and the band members were standing at the fence that they were behind. They're like, hey, come on backstage. And I'm like, oh, I still haven't. No, I can't do that. No. And the next thing you know, I'm not doing very well at that event, and I'm losing my mind. And all of a sudden, I saw a Heineken bottle, you know, big blow-up Heineken bottle. And I mean, I was 50 yards from it. And I was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous, that you tell another member of Alcoholics Anonymous the truth. I hope you do that. I'll lie to anyone out there. but I will tell you the truth. And I go walking toward her. You talk about that mental blank spot. You talk about whatever you want to call it. And I went, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to go have a beer. And I didn't even like Heineken. And I go walking towards that beer. And, I mean, my phone rang, and it was a guy I'd met in AA. He had 22 years. I answered the phone, which it was a cellular hole there at Zilker Park. And everybody's like, hey, can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? And I answered the phone, and I said, hello. And Dave says, hey, what are you doing? And I said, I'm getting ready to have a beer. And, I mean, he lost it. Very foul language, you know. Have you had one yet? Have you had one yet? I said, no. And he goes, wherever you are, get the hell out of there, you know. And, I mean, I pulled that cowboy hat down, and I just started walking, you know. And I was like, oh, my God. And I walked all the way to the IHOP and called Charlie. And I'm like, oh, my God, I'm losing my mind. I almost drank. And let me tell you, in that 50 yards, I had never done crack because I got sober in 84. And it was freebasing, but I hadn't done that. But I hadn't done crack. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to do a little crack. And now what I've heard about those crack houses, too, can you see me getting my ass kicked? I mean, you know, I'm like, you want me to do what? Oh, no, that ain't happening. But I'd never done crack, and I've heard it's pretty nasty. You know what you'll do? A little bit of loss of integrity there, you know? But, I mean, that's where I went to. And I got to tell you, God sends all of us lifeboat after lifeboat after lifeboat. He never stops. It's do I get in it and stay in it? You see, I had no idea how I was. Had I gone out, trust me, I'm the girl who doesn't come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just not. I got way too much pride. I'm going out to die, and both my children would have been without parents, and that's the honest to God truth. And Charlie saved my life. And people are like, nobody does. Whatever. Yes, he did. He saved my life because he's the only person that would make me not do anything. I mean, Mark Houston, you know, I thought he was cute. And I remember thinking, I thought, he's a good-looking guy. I can stare at him for a while. And I asked him a question at the break, and it was a stupid question. But did any of you guys know Mark Houston? Yeah. Raise your hand if you knew Mark Houston. Okay, you know how he could smoke a cigarette. I mean, he could pull a coal on that cigarette. He'd and I asked him a question, and he pulled that cigarette just down, and I'm looking at him thinking, wow. And then he goes, ho, ho, ho. And I thought, okay, I'm done. And I tried to leave that retreat three times, and walk of shame every time, I can tell you that, because I had no car, and it was raining, and we were at some Girl Scout camp. So Charlie goes, oh, for God's sakes, Katie. I'm like, I'm out of here. But I'm telling you, it was... If you're at all like my personality, be it male or female, I think I got more male in me than I have female. Of course, nowadays, Jesus, you can't even go down that road. Whatever. I just got it, man. I got a lot of whatever it is. So the bottom line is that Charlie and I, It was so interesting because our relationship, of course, became intimate. And I leaned over to kiss him. Joe's gone. I'm in my 40s, and I've been married 20 years. And I am flipping out. I mean, untreated alcoholism. And I leaned over to kiss Charlie, and I'll never forget. He goes, whoa! Whoa, Katie! And I'm like, what? And let me tell you, my boy chased the girls, and he landed a bunch. I like to say he procreated his way through Alcoholics Anonymous. He did. And I mean, he was a skirt chaser, and he landed it and everything. And when he did that, he goes, what are you doing? And I go, I don't know, man, I'm losing my mind. He goes, well, I'm not blowing a 20-year best friendship. We were like brother and sister. I mean, we talk on the phone six times a day. I'd help him build fences. My husband was never threatened by Charlie. I absolutely could not believe I was doing what I was doing. And I looked at him, and I thought, oh, okay. So I'm like, forget it then. And I go walking out, and I mean, I'm getting ready to get right to the doorknob, and he goes, whoa, 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 whoa. Let's talk about this. And I have the microphone, and you don't. And so I say, I turn around, and he goes, you know what, Katie, let's talk about this. Well, needless to say, we got past that, all right? Although when we first kissed, we did bang teeth several times, and then he went to lay me down, and I'm dense, and he dropped me, and I thought, oh, my God, you girls know, you're in your head going, oh, this is going so poorly. What was I doing? You know, once you've done something crazy like that as a woman, your head is just... I think Charlie was just like, whoa, hey. And I'm just like, what have I done? I just kissed my best friend. And it's been a fabulous relationship. I will tell you, we have worked our tail off because it took 7 years to get him marriage material. And he did it. And he's my best friend. He's my absolute best friend. I love Charlie Parker with all my heart. So I'm going to talk briefly about the second step. The second step, once again, I didn't read the big book for 17 years. And I was nailing it for the first year. But I didn't read the big book because I didn't feel like I had to. It didn't make much sense to me. This person I asked to be my sponsor was not a book person. She was a counseling person. And the chapters, we agnostics, and I believed in God. So I misunderstood we agnostics completely. And Mark Houston liked to say that we agnostics was one of the most profound chapters he'd ever read out of all 200 pieces of spiritual literature. So I'm going to just breeze through this because Lorenz is just not taking much time. And I'm taking all the time. So page 44 to 57, this is my take on we agnostics. The word agnostic means a one who neither affirms nor denies the existence of a personal deity. It's kind of interesting, right? And I love what it says. The big difference between atheist and agnostic. But I tell you, this is my take. It doesn't have to be yours. But if you got a problem with the second step, it's not a second step issue. It's a first step issue. You really don't believe you are powerless over alcohol, period. You still think you can get it done without the need for this. Now, I don't know what it's going to take for you to begin to understand that, but that's my understanding. I've worked with a lot of people, too, and that's basically the way I see it. I love on page 44, it says, the difference between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic, right? It sums up the doctor's opinion, there is a solution, more about alcoholism, Bill's story, in one paragraph. It says, in the preceding chapters, you have learned something of alcoholism. It's pretty important to ask yourself, have you? Because, you know, I mean, the truth of the matter is you hear people in AA meetings say, you know, my sister drinks a half a glass of wine, I don't understand it. I understand they're making a joke, but it's getting ready to explain it here. We hope we've made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. So when someone says that, they're not getting what the book is trying to tell them. It says, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. It says, if that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. I mean, they re-hit you with that again after all you've been through. And the truth of the matter is Charlie and I were at the movie theater, because I'm going to try to tie a ton of stories into this. Because I read the email. I called Lorenz. I go, what? Oh, my God. I'm always teaching. Yeah, okay. Stories, here they come. So we may only make it through the fourth step, okay? So I'm storytelling. Charlie and I are at the movie theater. And I don't know about you guys, but movie theaters kind of bug me. People in movie theaters, they break all the rules. They talk. They do all kinds of crazy stuff. So we're standing there in the popcorn line, and you know it's usually 15-year-olds working behind the counter. There's only one kid working. There's 9 counters to be manned, but obviously nobody's working these days, so nobody's there. So I'm standing there, and the guy is ordering in front of us, and then there's one guy in front of him, or behind him, and then Charlie and me, and then about 15 people behind us. And all of a sudden you see a kid come out with the money drawer and you're like, is he getting ready to open a second window? You know that moment? We miss nothing. Let's be very clear, right? And I think he is. And then all of a sudden he starts to open his window and he goes next in line, which would be the guy in front of us. But a guy shoots out from the back of the line and shoots over there. Well, I don't know about you guys. That is a violation. And Charlie and I just, we can't even believe it. We're like, oh. And the guy goes, Charlie goes, dude, that was supposed to be you. And he goes, it's not worth it. See, I don't get that. I get alcoholism and the non-alcoholic, but I don't get that. And we're like, come on, man, go over. You want me to take care of it? Because I can go over there. You remember that? Oh, yeah. So can I. And he came, and remember he came in our theater with that young girl. So I had him. Yeah, he was probably 50 and he had a 20-year-old with him. I'm like, okay, okay, he's that guy. So in the first step, we're not trying to convince you that you got a problem, but that you have no solution. You know you have a problem. You don't come into Alcoholics Anonymous not knowing you got a problem drinking. People have been talking about my problem for a long time. I don't realize I don't have a solution, right? And by the time when I pick up the drink, it's not the problem. It is the solution. See, you got time, and then all of a sudden you pick up a drink. You know it's wrong, but it's what you got to have. See, so it's just such a mind game there. And why would I be interested in that power if I thought on my own power would get the job done? I'm telling you, people are like, oh, I got a buddy that's, you know, he's got a real problem with the second step. I'm like, nah, it ain't the second step. He's not willing to surrender. And Mike is the best at explaining surrender. I just love the way Mike goes about some of his stuff. He has such a way of wording things where you're just like, you're just completely in the whole deal. You know, the way he uses examples, he said, when I called him, I said, you know, Mike, how are we going to do this deal? You know, Charlie and I usually do this dance. And he goes, well, Katie, it's kind of like when you go to the hospital and they put the dye in you, you know, we're going to see where the group glows from the dye. Okay. I'm with you on that. So we figured out the glow in the beginning, right? So then you get us. The set-aside prayer is a beautiful prayer, right? Help me set aside everything I think I know, because I think I know everything. You remember when you were a kid, they go, you're such a know-it-all. Well, I still am, up in my head. When you say something, I go, oh, God, I don't agree with that at all. Right? I mean, this sucker is rattling away all the time, right? So our program's about an intimate relationship with the God of your understanding. Oh, my gosh. You know, we throw the gate so flipping wide open. All we have is identification and power. That's it. We ain't changing, okay? If you got a problem with that, go start something down the road. But all we have is identification and power. We throw the gate so wide open, that power can be anything you want. But why in the world? It'd be like me going to Jiffy Lube and saying, hey, man, I need you guys to clean my teeth. They go, lady, we just changed oil. I don't care. I want you to change your tenants here because I want you to clean my teeth. See, that's all AA has. And some people come in here and they will fight that second part. And you're like, why? Go start something else. Go start the We Don't Want God program, you know? Don't expect us to change what we're doing. You know, I talked to this chick one time on the phone, and I really liked her, and I talk all day long, AA, I'm retired. I do 9 to 5. So if you got a problem after 5, call someone else, because that's what I do. Everybody knows that. And unless I really like you, and then sometimes I'll take it after 5. But so this girl, I really like this chick. She's 5 years sober, and she said, I need to tell you I'm atheist. And I said, really? And I said, golly, I don't have a lot to offer you. If you're atheist. And she goes, well, I go to about 2 or 3 meetings a day. I said, I bet you do. And I told her, I said, honestly, I really can't help you. If you're going to stand firm in that, you're welcome to call me. I'll sit there and visit with you, because I really liked her. But she said, I'm in trouble. Well, that's not hard to figure out why. But I'm not going to convince you that that's not going to work. You're going to have that experience. Remember, I talked about that. You got to go out there and have that experience. But please don't come in here toting that stuff like you're not going to get some flack. That's my preaching there. We bridge the gap, right? The doctor's opinion is the allergy to page 24. That's where we're talking about the physical allergy. Charlie does a great job about talking about it in his story, so he's really going to hit this. Bill's story is the progression of alcoholism, and we agnostics is about setting aside our prejudice. See, I thought it was always just about religion. It's about our prejudice, our prejudgment of everything, right? And let me tell you something. We are some judgmental son of a guns. You may not see it, but up here it is rattling away. What was she thinking wearing that shirt? Oh, God almighty. That is way too much cleavage. Whoa, wow. You know what I mean? Or oh, my God, does that guy realize that, and it's not as bad as it used to be, but if I'm not spiritually fit, it's ugly. It's really ugly. And, oh, driving? Oh, you know. Oh, I guess this guy's the goodwill ambassador of the world. He's going to let everybody in. Or you come to a four-way stop. We live on a street where there's four-way stops, about five of them. Oh, my God, people, wake up when you come to the stop. Who's next? Are we all just going to stop? You know, come on. Jeez. So it says on page 45, lack of power, that was our dilemma. A dilemma is a very interesting thing, right? That's, once again, that whole dilemma. It says, obviously, but where and how are we to find that power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. And I didn't touch it. Not touch it at all. I know I'm not alone in that. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. So it's telling us that. Why in the world would we fight that? Why would you go to AA? Be like me, like Charlie likes to say, like going to PTA and not having any kids. And trust me, PTA is no fun, okay? It's already no fun. It says about half our fellowship had a problem with God. So let me ask you this, and Charlie, this is a little game we play. On day one, when you came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, how many of you guys had a problem with God? Shocking, half our fellowship. Still, I don't care if it's 1,000 people, it's half the crowd. Still is today. And then I love, because it says, half our fellowship had a problem with God. Still is today. It says, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. Only us. We're like, okay, can you enlarge that doomed? Because, you know, I'm still not 100% sure. I was doing a 12-step call with a buddy of mine's daughter. So she wasn't in the room yet. I had him, my buddy, and then the grandmother. And I read that line, and he goes, whoa, hold on. He goes, read that line again. I said, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live along spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives. See, that just rolls off our tongue. And he goes, really? I thought, yeah, I guess I could probably consider that a little more before I go lobbing that out to you, you know. He says, do I believe this? Are these my two choices? All we have is that identification and power. See, staying sober is the bare minimum. I thought it was the finish line. See, I love the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I fell in love with the fellowship, so did Charlie. So I loved AA so much. And then, you know, all of a sudden, physically, you start to feel better. I mean, I'm at the goddamn grocery store at 5 a.m. because I live on coffee, right? It's like, I'm going to grocery shop. You know, I'm brand new sober, and I just cannot even believe what life looks like. So I didn't get what the third step's trying to tell me, what the root of my trouble is, because I loved AA. I loved all of this stuff, and I didn't have that misery. And today what I found out is I'm one of the lucky ones, because I loved AA, so did Charlie. And because we loved Alcoholics Anonymous and the fellowship, it bought us a little more time than the guy who came in on day one and hated it. Just is what it is. The book talks about prejudice 6 times, right? Prejudice means to prejudge without examination. It says, the words, I love what they use in the book. We beg of you to lay aside prejudice. Beg. You're like, yeah, whatever. even against organized religion. right? This prejudice is unbelievable, right? We're trying to get us to a loving God, this current relationship. So what we've got is self-reliance versus God-reliance. Now, I don't know about you guys. I love self-reliance. I really do. It works. I talked to a boss of mine at 18 years old. I talked him into letting me off in the summer. He said, he goes, like school? And I went, yeah. And he goes, okay. And we hired a Kelly girl. I mean, why would I want to set that tool down? That's incredible. I mean, think about your self-reliance. Charlie said his didn't work very well for him, but mine works very well. So this self-reliance and God-reliance, we're looking for the still, quiet voice. That's the voice we're listening to. We had it drunk, and we had it sober. You'd hear it drunk. It's where, you know, God, you're hearing this, don't go. Don't get in the car. Stay. Right? That's the same thing. Every one of us has it. Down deep inside, every man, woman, and child is that fundamental idea of God. 4 through 9 gets us unblocked from the sunlight of the Spirit, right? And 10 and 11 are the disciplines that keep us unblocked. The 12 step, continue to practice these principles in all our affairs and carry the message. So it's got two parts to the 12 step. I hear people talk about living amends. There is no such thing as a living amends in my book. Now, I know, I'm getting a little cocky now, aren't I, Mike? Uh-huh, I know, he told me, be careful. I think it's practice these principles in all our affairs, right? Become the person that you want to show your family who you are. You know, just be the good person. The bedevilments we've already talked about, the only problem is here, I fall asleep, right? I go through life and I quit working a program and then next thing you know, man, I'm falling asleep. I've got one really serious road rage, and we haven't gone a whole hour yet, but I'm going to go ahead and knock it out. When it says, if a mere code of morals or better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago, right? I know to be a good person. I know not to lie. I know not to cuss in public, right? I know to wear somewhat reasonable apparel from time to time. And I'm okay with spanking. It's not up for debate. If you don't believe in spanking, so be it. But I believed in spanking. I grew up on spanking, and I'll spank you at Disney World, you know, right through the line. I'll hold that arm up and whack you all the way down. But I don't believe in slapping my kids in the face. I never was slapped in the face. I was spanked. I spanked my kids. I don't spank my grandkids because that's against the rules. But I will spank my own children, but I won't slap them in the face. I slapped both my kids in untreated alcoholism. I slapped my daughter when she was 12 and my son when he was 15. They're 10 years apart. And no one was more shocked than I was that I slapped these kids. I mean, I knocked the tar out of them, too. I was untreated alcoholism under tremendous stress. And when I went to make the amends to my daughter, it was well into her. She's 43 now. And I went to make the amends to her, and she said, oh, Mom, that didn't even make the top 10. I am devastated over that behavior. You can steal in untreated alcoholism. You can have an affair in untreated alcoholism, right? You can do way more than you ever did drinking. And Charlie and I, it looked like I wasn't going to get my life insurance on my husband, which was really something I needed, and they supposedly I marked something on his insurance that was inaccurate, and it had to do with a doctor's office. Charlie likes to say we were watching a lot of Tony Soprano, but Charlie goes, you know what, Katie, I'm going to put $1,000 in my pocket. We're going to go talk to that doctor, and we were going to bribe him, and I had no problem with that. Because you know what? It was my money. I'd been paying on that insurance, and it was up, you know, debatable. And thank God that doctor never answered the questions wrong. So when we walked out of there, I was thinking, wow, we were going to try to bribe a doctor. And we're both, you know, 17, 18 years sober. It talks about logic, right? Logic's good stuff. We like it. We like it a lot. It's that self-reliance. If you're not careful, that self-reliance kicks in. The voice of reason, right? We fall asleep. And we don't even realize it. Then I find that I need the power again. I am so out of my mind when Joe got sick, and he was sick for 6 years, and all I know to do is make money, right? I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I was raised, you work your tail off. And I go out there, and I make a ton of money, and I'm good at making money. And we're in gridlock traffic going towards my job, and I don't know, three lights were out on Lamar, if y'all know Austin. And so you sit at a red light, and if you're not careful, somebody will cheat their red light, and then they block you out. So you got to sit through the whole system again. And I'm late for work, and this guy and I are just inching in. And I'm thinking, I'm not giving up, man. And he's not giving up either. And it's right at a college, so it's a bunch of young kids. And I won't even go down that road, how challenged they make me. And he pushes, and he's going to hit my car. And it's just going to be this, right, because we're at a gridlock. And I think, oh, my God. So I just stop, and I think, go ahead. And it was something about the way he went. And he put his arm up like that. And I thought, oh. And, I mean, it was like you heard a twig snap. And I mean, I get out of my car. Oh, yeah. I have never hit a man, nor have I ever been hit. I don't know where I'm going with this. But I get my hands like this, and I just knock the side of his car. I said something really, really ugly, and he goes. And when he turned to look at me, he had not put his car in park, and it rolls forward, and it hits the car in front of him. Just bumps it, but just enough. And, I mean, he is pissed. Then he opens the door, and he's trying to get out, and he hadn't still got a seatbelt on. Now I got to tell you, at this point, everything's in slow motion, and I'm thinking it is hilarious, right? Now, we're in gridlock traffic, and we are in Texas, okay? He comes out of his car. When he unhooks that thing, I realize I'm totally out of game. I got no idea what to do. Oh, my God, did my shirt just come unbuttoned? So he comes out of his car, and he goes to take a swing at me, and I'm backing up, and he catches my shoulder, my glasses fly off, but we are in Texas, and we are in gridlock traffic. So a couple of guys jump out of two different cars. One guy has a billy club, because we are in Texas, and gets that billy club, and he's holding the guy by his throat. Oh, my God, did that top go? He's holding him by his throat, and I misread the whole thing. I think he's trying to tell me to come back at him. So. And I'm just yelling at the guy, and the guy goes, get the F out of here, man, lady. And I'm like, oh, sorry, I read that wrong. I jump back in my car, and it was like, I swear, parting the Red Sea. Like an ambulance was coming through. Everybody had watched it, and they all part. And I drive through, and when I pulled into my parking lot, it was not but two blocks. It was as if I came out of a blackout. It was devastating. I mean, I just burst into tears. I'm like, oh, my God, what is wrong with me? What just happened? You know, and I was telling this story one time, and a guy came up to me and goes, did you make an amends to him? Really, dude, is that what you got out of a complete stranger? When I'm supposed to put a sign up and go, hey, I caused some problems last week. Yeah, I'm the chick in the little red SI Civic, you know. Says God does not make too hard of terms for those who seek him, right? And those terms we'll get into in the third step. It says to us, the realm of the spirit is broad. Oh, my gosh, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding for those who earnestly seek. I cannot tell you guys what my life looks like today. I am not that girl. And Lorenz was the one who said to me one time when I'd called him for the 100th debacle. He said, you know, Katie, he goes, what would happen if you took the high road? And I remember thinking, huh. I never, ever have taken the high road. And he said, I said, Mike, I don't even know how to get there. I really don't. I mean, I'm a fighter. I don't know how to get there. And then he talked about it, and I can't even begin to tell you. I'd love to say the next day I did, but it stumped me. You know what that looks like, to be stumped. And all of a sudden you're like, oh, my God, this is really interesting. I love it. Each step tells us when to take it, how to take it, and why to take it, right? Praying for God's will is easy. Accepting God's will is not. God either is or he isn't. Thank you so much.